This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A new report measures the outsized role of manufacturing in much of downstate Illinois.
But it has the economic multiplier just ripples across the state in these counties.
Mark Densler from the Illinois Manufacturers Association on what people don't know about what's made here in Illinois. Plus, it's high school graduation weekend in Bloomington Normal, a little early perhaps, but way earlier for a couple of grads Eric Stock talks with. Arts correspondent Laura Kennedy features poet and photographer Justin Hamm and his new exhibit, and bluesman Patrick Sweeney meets GLT's John Norton and you. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A new report makes the case that manufacturing jobs are still a very important cog in Illinois' economic engine, especially for downstate counties. While Bloomington Normal's economy may not be heavily reliant on manufacturing, the opposite is true in Peoria, Tazewell, and Macon counties. GLT's Ryan Denham talks to Illinois Manufacturers Association President and CEO Mark Densler about his group's new economic analysis.
I don't think people realize the magnitude and the scope of what is manufactured in the state of Illinois and the impact that it has on our economy. You know, today there are 592,000 men and women that are employed on factory floors, earning an average wage of more than $88,000 a year. Manufacturing is the single largest sector of the state's economy, generating about 12% of our gross state product. And I think we have an amazing story to tell. And I don't think that most people realize, again, the scope and magnitude of manufacturing in Illinois.
What are your takeaways in this report as it relates to downstate counties, places like Peoria, Tazewell, and Macon counties?
Well, certainly that manufacturing, while we have almost 600,000 workers, that it has an outsized influence, particularly in some downstate counties. I grew up in Decatur. Macon County, 40% of their GDP comes from the manufacturing sector. Nearly a quarter of the GDP in Peoria County comes from manufacturing, you know, a third of it in Tazewell County. So, you know, many of these downstate communities are even more reliant on manufacturing than maybe some of the suburban communities. However, I think most people would be surprised to find, you know, that Lake County, 27% of their GDP comes from manufacturing, and it's one of the most manufacturing-intense areas in the state of Illinois.
So in these places downstate where manufacturing plays sort of an outsized role in the economy, how does that actually affect, like, the quality of life and the overall economy in that place? Is it any different there?
Well, actually, it enhances it. So a couple things that we're especially proud of, Ryan. First of all, manufacturing has the largest economic multiplier of any sector. So for every dollar invested in manufacturing, an additional $1.89 is added to the economy. And we also have one of the highest multiplier rates when it comes to jobs. So for every direct job in manufacturing, an additional 1.6 jobs are created in the state of Illinois. You know, so combined there, you know, we have about 6 million people in the workforce, and a quarter of those are directly or indirectly linked to the state's manufacturing sector. So, you know, not only do we contribute a huge amount of the gross state product and have an undue influence in some of these counties, but it has the economic multiplier just ripples across the state in these counties.
Well, my perception of the manufacturing industry is, you think of a company like Caterpillar, right? It seems like they're very susceptible to the ups and downs of the global economy. You know, a slowdown overseas may disrupt things here. You know, business slows down, people are laid off here. Is that a downside for these downstate communities that have higher than average reliance on manufacturing jobs, that kind of roller coaster?
I mean, you know, certainly I think every sector has its ups and downs, and we live in cyclical times where, again, you know, in 2008, 2009, things were difficult. But, you know, again, just the profound impact of manufacturing and what is made here. When you look at what's made in the state of Illinois, life-saving products. We help feed the world. We power our homes and businesses, provide for the nation's defense. We have a very robust and diverse manufacturing economy. The single largest share of manufacturing is food products, and then chemical manufacturing, and then heavy equipment. And there are some very cool things. Everyone knows Caterpillar and John Deere, for example. But, there are, all the Red Salvation Army kettles are made in Illinois. Or up in Rockford, they're machining the Orion space pod, which is going to take man further into space than ever before. Or in Pekin, Illinois, not far away from you, 85% worldwide of the aluminum lids made in food products, such as Pringles or Yoplait yogurt, are made in Pekin, Illinois. And so, one of the things that we want to tell is that manufacturing is diverse, it's cool, it's no longer kind of dark, dirty, and dangerous that we thought of maybe our parents' or grandparents' generation. That manufacturing today is high-tech, it's automated, it's clean, it's sustainable, and we have a great story to tell.
Well, on the other side of the spectrum is a county like McLean County. It's a very white-collar, university town. Less than 2% of our GDP is coming from manufacturing, which is, way less than the statewide average of 12%. So what do you see when you look at a county like McLean? Does that reflect some kind of lack of economic diversity?
Well, and I love McLean County. I went to Illinois Wesleyan University, so I know McLean County pretty well, but you've actually seen somewhat of a resurgence with the Rivian facility. You have Brandt there, which are both a couple brand new facilities or companies that are in McLean County who've done a nice job of actually adding manufacturing to the mix. And hopefully both of those will continue to grow. But I certainly think diverse economies are very good for a county or for a state. In Bloomington Normal and McLean County for a long time obviously has been known for higher education and insurance. And I think that you are starting to see an uptick with some new manufacturing balance with folks like Bloomington Beer Nuts and Boppy that have been around for some time. So I think diversity is important, and it's a good thing.
Yeah, so given that long tail, the supply chain that comes with manufacturing jobs, are we going to see McLean County's economy changing as a result of Rivian and Brandt? Are we going to see suppliers start to pop up?
That's certainly very possible. I mean, when you talk about manufacturing and we talk about for every manufacturing job, there's 1.6 jobs directly related to it. And so the automotive sector in Rivian, there are, more than 1,000 auto suppliers in Illinois. And certainly we see oftentimes when you have a large manufacturer, and if Rivian does create 1,000 or 2,000 jobs, certainly I would expect that some of their suppliers would probably be located very close to them. I know Rivian's had a number of discussions with some partners, and with recent investments they've had in the company, things seem to be going very well. But again, keep in mind, when you have good manufacturing jobs that pay an average $88,000 a year, those are the good middle-class jobs that the men and women working in them, they can then, send their kids to college, they can buy a new car, they can eat at the restaurants. And so, they do have a profound, not only a jobs impact, but again, the economic impact because they are the good middle-class jobs.
So what's the hiring picture right now for Illinois manufacturing? Are you finding the right workers? Are we still seeing a skills mismatch, skills gap?
It's a great question, and that is a real struggle that manufacturers have today. As I noted, we have about 592,000 men and women working in factory floors today, but there are thousands of openings around the state. And with the unemployment rate, hovering around 3.5-4%, it's a challenge to find people to go into manufacturing. Part of that is the perception, as I mentioned, of that it's dark, dirty, and dangerous. We've lost kind of vocational education in our high schools and our community colleges. We're starting to see that shift a little bit. That a young man or woman can get out of high school, get a little additional training, go work in manufacturing, making great pay with benefits, and not having $100,000 or $200,000 worth of college debt. And so we're really struggling though to attract people to manufacturing. And nationally, interestingly, there were more than 500,000 openings in manufacturing. There are more openings in manufacturing plants than there were workers seeking jobs. And so it's not only manufacturing, it's nursing and teaching that there are a lot of industries right now that are struggling because of the low employment to find workers.
It's interesting how you talked about the perception of manufacturing jobs as dark, dirty, and dangerous. You know, I kind of see the flip side of that, where I think that at times America has sort of romanticized manufacturing jobs. You think of like steel workers and people who make American cars, that kind of thing. What do you make of that disconnect between those two different perceptions?
Well, we're trying to certainly let folks know. We have Manufacturing Day, Manufacturing Month in October, where we'll have a couple hundred events or a couple hundred companies open their doors to the public. And we have to do a better job because, again, a lot of folks still think of manufacturing what it was like 30 or 40 years ago. And my dad worked at Staley Manufacturing in Decatur. And, you know, you think that people come home, you know, and they kind of smell and they're dirty. But you go on the factory floors today, and, again, they're clean, they're high-tech, they're robotic, they're automated. And like we like to tell kids, you know, research and development, what you make. I mean, the iPhone's only about 10 years old now. And again, a lot of cool things are made in Illinois. And once we tell that story and we show young men and women, they're certainly interested in working in manufacturing plants. We just have to make sure we tell our story.
This is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham, speaking with Mark Densler, President and CEO of the Illinois Manufacturers Association. So, Mark, I want to pivot here and talk trade. Obviously, there's been a lot going on with U.S. trade policy, most recently another conflict over tariffs. So how have these trade disputes affected your members here in the Illinois Manufacturers Association?
Well, I would tell you, you know, first of all, trade is critically important. As I like to say, 95% of the world's consumers live outside the United States. And so it is important for American companies, Illinois companies, to be able to sell their products around the country or around the world. You have to have trade agreements. They have to be fair. You know, in 93% of Illinois exports are manufactured products. So the trade issue, the tariff issue is vitally important to manufacturers, the agricultural sector. What I would tell you is that trade wars don't benefit anybody. You know, they are not good things. However, at the same time, we have to stand up for American jobs and American manufacturing. And certainly we have seen incidents in China where, you know, they've been cheating. There's been intellectual property theft. There's been dumping of products on marketplaces. So, you know, what we really need is we need good trade agreements, whether it be with Canada and Mexico, who are important trade partners, whether it's with China or the European Union. And there's a number of ways that we can work on those. Right now, the president is trying some tariffs. We'll have to wait and see if they work. But at the end of the day, it's important for manufacturers to be able to trade around the world, but it has to be done in a fair manner.
What parts of the manufacturing industry have been most impacted here?
Well, you have, you know, there's certainly a little split in the manufacturing sector. You certainly have steel companies. When the president talked about tariffs on steel and aluminum, that were very supportive of the president doing that. And then conversely, you know, you have seen companies publicly, you know, John Deere and Caterpillar and others have talked about the increased cost because of the tariffs and the negative impact on it. So, you know, it depends on what sector that you're in. You know, there are some folks that certainly applaud them. There are others that have concerns about them. The automotive sector certainly has great concerns about what's going on with tariffs. I know the president's delayed the auto tariffs again for a couple more months, but creating some uncertainty and instability out there. But again, at the end of the day, trade is very important for the manufacturing sectors. Free trade, fair trade, and trade wars don't help anybody.
How is this going to affect consumer prices on the things that your membership, you know, builds and makes for people?
You know, we'll have to wait and see. I mean, how all these things play out. You know, certainly, you know, some things could cost more, other things could cost less. Just depends on the products and, you know, what other countries do. I mean, hopefully we'll avoid all that and that the president and Congress will be able to ratify the trade agreement, for example, with Mexico and Canada, and we'll get some good trade agreements with others and we'll get people back to work in Illinois.
That's Mark Densler, president and CEO of the Illinois Manufacturers Association. I'm Ryan Denham.
You can find a link to the Illinois Manufacturers Association new report and economic analysis through our website, WGLT.org.
Hear the top NPR and local GLT news stories handpicked just for you right now on the NPR One app. Listen to GLT newscasts and our biggest stories on demand, or settle in for some podcast listening. You can even customize your favorite types of stories. NPR One has it all. Think Spotify or Pandora for news. This is GLT.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, a poet and photographer combines his work in a new exhibit. Laura Kennedy, our arts correspondent, has more. I'm Charlie Schlenker. It may seem a bit early for Bloomington Normal Schools to hold graduation during the Memorial Day weekend, but for at least two Twin Cities students who will be donning cap and gown, graduation comes especially early. GLT's Eric Stock introduces us to two go-getters who finished their classes a year ahead of their classmates.
Campbell Albaugh from Normal West High School and Taylor Harper of Bloomington High School are both able to graduate early. I want to know how you both were able to do that, but we'll start with you, Campbell. Why did you decide to move on after high school a year early?
Well, my main reason was that I know after high school I'm going to college and I'd like to eventually get my doctorate, so I knew I'd have a lot of college coming up after that, so I figured I'd just get a head start on that.
And Taylor, how about you?
I wasn't finding a lot of my classes stimulating. I was getting tired of doing the same thing over and over, and I wanted to change a pace.
How are you both able to make this happen? That has to be a pretty demanding schedule, right?
Yeah, what I had to do is I had to take three extra classes each semester. I took first semester, I took them online at Illinois Virtual Schooling, and they were fairly easy. And then second semester, I did it through a place in town near the Coliseum called RAS, Regional Alternative Schooling, and it was just pretty straight to the point. I just went into my counselor, and she helped me get it all set up.
And Taylor, how much of a challenge was it for you to be able to get this work done a year early?
I actually didn't have a hard time doing it. I took four classes before high school. I took math early and a foreign language. So when I hit high school, I didn't have to take as many math classes, which allowed me to double up on English this year.
What were some of the classes that you felt maybe not sufficiently challenged, or was it all of them? Taylor?
I wasn't feeling particularly challenged in my English classes or a lot of my science classes. Even the AP classes didn't provide me with what I felt was a lot of challenge.
Now let's take a look at what you have next. You're both 17 years old. Now, Campbell, we understand that you're going to Ball State for exercise science and physical therapy.
Yes.
Explain what you look to do with that.
Well, I'd like to just get 4 years there. I actually looked into getting that done in 3 years, but it doesn't seem like that's quite a possibility. What I'll be doing is I'll get that, and then I'll go on, like I said, to eventually get my doctorate. And I'd like to work in pediatric physical therapy or become a sports trainer. I know with Ball State, they have a really cool program where you could intern with the Pacers, which would be a really good in for that. And long term, I'd like to open my own practice.
And Ball State in Muncie, Indiana, not too far away from Indianapolis.
Mm-hmm.
And Taylor, you'll be studying forensic science at George Mason University in Virginia. What do you see yourself doing?
I see myself going into either law enforcement or the federal level of analyzing objects that come from crime scenes to figure out what happened.
So you're going to be sort of like Abby from NCIS?
Yeah.
So you're a fan of the show?
Yes.
I imagine so. Is that what drew you to this, or were there other elements?
I wanted to do something with science, but I didn't want it to be all the time over and over, like analyzing chemical compounds just by themselves. I wanted something that would actually make a difference in the world.
You get a start a year early on college, and Campbell, you talked about trying to get out in 3 years. I guess it's a little bit different than when I went to school, and not that it was that long ago, but after high school, you planned for 4 years of college, and then you moved into your career about 21, 22 years old. But it seems like a lot of those same careers 4 years will not be enough. You are now getting advanced degrees, perhaps getting your master's or your doctorate in some cases, and you're looking at a considerable length of school time, and both of you are looking at this with the careers that you're pursuing. Did that factor into this decision to graduate high school early to be able to limit the amount of time that you're going to be spending in the classroom in the future?
That definitely did have a factor for me, at least. I know I was just ready to get a head start on that, and right now it looks like it's going to take me 8 years, but I'm trying to see if there's any way I could get out in 7 or maybe less.
And Taylor?
It's similar for me. I would like to get an advanced degree, and possibly doing it in a lesser amount of time would be great.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Eric Stock with Campbell Albaugh from Normal West High School and Taylor Harper from Bloomington High School. Both are going to be graduating this weekend, 1 year ahead of schedule. There are clearly benefits to leaving school early. I imagine there could be a financial benefit. Certainly, you're going to be in position to start making money earlier, paying off those student loans. Were finances a possible factor in either of your decisions from your standpoint or your family's standpoint?
I know it's definitely something I looked at. Student loans just keep getting more and more expensive, and I figured there was no reason to wait a year and let the prices keep going up, so I figured I'd just get started now.
And Taylor?
Student loans, getting them paid off is a major factor for me. I have two brothers who also will have to go to school or already are in school, and they have student debt, so my family can't pay for all of it, so if I can go to school in the least amount of time or get out early, then it'll be very beneficial.
One of the potential drawbacks to leaving early is the friends you make at school you may not see much of after school, especially in your cases because you're moving out of state. Did that make the decision more difficult?
It wasn't too challenging for me. I've been in marching band throughout all of high school, and so you just kind of become friends with whoever is there, and a lot of my friends are actually seniors this year, so it was kind of easier for me.
And Taylor?
I didn't find it very hard to leave a lot of my friends, especially since I have a lot of friends who are seniors, so they will be moving off to college as well, and none of us are going to be in the same area, so it wasn't too bad.
What kind of feedback have you had from friends about you doing this, about this accelerated plan to move on from high school? Would you recommend anyone else trying it?
I've had a lot of positive feedback from my friends. They're amazed that I was able to do something like this, and a lot of them just see it as a big challenge I was able to overcome. And I would suggest it to some people, but not everybody. And if you're going to do it, I'd suggest starting classes your freshman year. That way you don't have to do it all at once. It'd be more of a progressive thing.
And Taylor?
I think a lot of my friends have agreed with me that graduating early is a wonderful idea, but a lot of them struggle with the idea of leaving everybody behind so early. I have quite a few friends who were able to graduate early along with me if they wanted to, but they felt that doing another year would have boosted both their college admissions possibilities and kept them with their friends and been able to participate in their activities longer.
And I wonder what your parents think, because in one sense they might like the financial advantages of you being able to move on, but many parents sort of dread the day where their child leaves home and goes off to school. And in your case, you're both doing it a year earlier. So what were those conversations with your parents like?
It was actually pretty interesting. I first got the idea from my mom because she said it in passing at one point, like, if you did this and this, you could graduate this year. And so I just kind of pushed it aside, didn't think about it. And once I really decided, they just wanted to make sure that I was sure about it and they were going to be fully supportive. And just with how long this year has been with all of the classes and just everything that's happened, my parents have gotten to a point where they're just like, it feels like it's time.
All right, Taylor, how about your parents?
Well, I mentioned it in passing my freshman year of high school that I wanted to graduate early, and I showed them like I could do it, and they were like, no, you shouldn't do that. But then it came on my sophomore year, and I was planning my classes for my junior year, and it worked out that I had a lot of friends who were leaving and I didn't want to stay around and be left behind without them. So I managed to convince my counselor that it was a great idea, and she helped me convince my parents.
So it was an easy sell after that.
Yeah.
And when, from what I understand, Taylor, you had lost your father to a brain aneurysm when you were in the seventh grade. I know junior high can be a very challenging time, even in a perfect circumstance. But with the sudden loss of a loved one, trying to manage that as well, how were you able to stay on track academically and in every other way as well while coping with the loss of your father?
It definitely was hard first coming off it. It happened in December, so I took like a week off from school, and then I came back and I didn't tell any of my friends what happened. My teachers all knew. But then I had all of winter break, and then when I got back in the spring semester, I just kind of put myself into my classes to kind of forget it, like not forget, but to try and get over it. And then it felt like he was pushing me forward later. Just, I wanted to do my best because I knew he would have been proud of me.
And you'll be thinking about him this weekend, I'm sure, on graduation. And this is Sound Ideas with two early graduates graduating from high school a year early, Taylor Harper of Bloomington High School, Campbell Albaugh from Normal West High School. And aside from the academics that you both excelled in, you're involved in many other activities. Taylor with soccer, Campbell, as you mentioned, with the band. How have you managed to juggle all that? You know, sometimes when you're in school, time management can be a challenge. So how have you been able to juggle all that and still be successful on an accelerated academic schedule?
It's actually been a little challenging, but it's made it a little easier because when you have this more weighted academic schedule and all of these activities, you have to be more diligent about time management. So at the start, I was a little rough with it, and then I realized I really had to be on it. And so it's helped me become more consistent with when I do certain things. And so it's just helped me prepare more.
That sounds easy, but easier said than done, right?
Yeah.
All right, Taylor.
It's definitely a lot easier to figure out how to time manage when you have, like, I have a sport, and if I don't keep my grades up, I can't play. So you have to definitely figure out how to time manage in order to not let down your team or yourself, because you want to do your best.
What will you be thinking of as you take the arena stage this weekend and prepare for your final days at high school to be over?
Really, I'll just be mainly thinking about relaxing this summer. With band, we always have the summers full, so it's kind of like a summer off in a sense. I'll be just thinking about what's coming ahead of me and just moving forward and doing my best.
Okay, and Taylor?
I'll definitely be thinking of my family. A lot of them are coming to see me as I am going away, but I get to take care of my brother all summer, and he's kind of sad that I'm leaving, but I definitely know that they're proud of me.
Well, it's good that you get to spend some extra time with them here over the next few weeks. Any advice that you would offer a classmate or friend or sibling that may say, I'd like to try that to get on with college a year early? What advice would you offer them that would make it possible for them to do?
I'd really just say, don't burn out. I know I had a few weekends where I worked really, really hard, and then I just lose momentum the coming week. And it was just try and be more steady with it and don't put stuff off. Just remember in the middle that there is an end and you just have to keep working.
And Taylor?
Definitely start thinking about it early. If you want to reach the point where you can graduate from high school early, don't force yourself to like get over involved in your classes, because you will burn out. Try to spread it all out. Don't procrastinate.
That's Taylor Harper of Bloomington High School and Campbell Albaugh of Normal West School with GLT's Eric Stock. Normal West and Normal Community are holding graduation ceremonies tomorrow. BHS's graduation is set for Sunday. Each of them will be at Grossinger Motors Arena.
Support for GLT comes from the Central Illinois Regional Airport, encouraging travelers to support the local economy and enjoy a convenient airport experience, including free parking. CIRA says, don't travel before you travel. Fly local. Details and schedules at CIRA.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, the music of Patrick Sweeney. Sagging barns and rusted-out cars in the rural landscape offer inspiration to artist Justin Hamm, who needs more than just words and more than just images to express his feelings about what he encounters out in the Midwest. GLT arts correspondent Laura Kennedy has more.
Justin Hamm ventured out to find the right words for his poetry and found a language in the images he found in the landscape. The former Twin Cities resident now lives in Missouri, where he continues his work exploring the Midwest. Hamm's photos and poems are currently on view at the Normal Public Library through July. Entitled Midwestern, Hamm says the show explores loss and decay in the landscape, finding life and inspiration where surrender abides nearby.
It's mournful and sad because there is a lot of decay around us. But if you also look at about that some of those things, you see the sturdiness of the past as well. Many of those things could be totally gone, but they are stubborn, kind of like people in the Midwest sometimes, and they don't totally disappear.
You have photos along with your poems in the exhibition. Are the photos specifically inspiring the poems, or do you just take the photos and then eventually just match them up with some of your poems? How does that work?
When I first started taking photos, the idea behind them was just to take photos so that I could bring them back and use them for descriptions in my poetry and fiction. And after a while, some people had positive responses to them, and some people, like my dad especially, was very supportive about this. He said, you know, people will want to see these. And so it became an artistic endeavor kind of in its own right. So the poems and the photographs are not explicitly paired. The photographs aren't meant to illustrate exactly what's in the poems, but they often inspire something. And so I like to think of it as the landscape of the photographs is the setting that my poems take place in. What I hope for is that a viewer, in looking at it, can do what I do with them, which is to place themselves or place some characters in the scene and have that be an impetus toward some sort of creation for themselves.
I found that your poems seem to elevate the everyday, talking about folk singers, talking about farmers. Can you talk to me about your inspiration for your poems?
I love the everyday. In fact, in my first book, I have a poem called The Everyday Parade, which is just a list of everyday things that are, as Allen Ginsberg would put it, holy. And so I'm kind of obsessed with that. I think poets and photographers both tend to be watchers and people watchers. The everyday has a lot of drama in it. Something as simple as an old thing sitting in a field has a certain drama to it or a story. Everyday things are extremely interesting to me, and I hope that by photographing them or describing them in a poem in a certain way, that I can pass that love on to somebody else.
Looking at your poems and reading, like the one about your grandfather, and also looking at some of these photos of old rusted out cars, there is a sense of loss, but the sense of loss isn't just about the things that eventually decay, but a sense of loss of spirit.
When I'm out there taking photographs especially, I'm kind of taken with that sense of loss. I can see there's something of the spirit of maybe what it means to be American that's eroded over time, and I do definitely want to capture that. It's kind of a double-edged sword with, you know, the past being out there, people having old rusted things on their lawns. America carries its past with us, and it's always on our lawn, metaphorically. And that can be a good thing. It can remind us of how well-built things are in the past, and it can inspire us, but it can also be a hindrance as well. You know, if those things are always looming and we're always looking to the past, thinking that that's the only place that positive things exist, that's not necessarily such a good thing either.
Now, we don't want to get people the idea that your work is just so steeped in melancholy and it's all just sad. There is, I think, some humor in your work as well. Do you find them to be a potent pair, like sadness and humor?
Oh, absolutely. You have to have that mix. If you don't, then it's hard for people to take that all in huge doses. But also, it wouldn't be a very honest depiction of the world, or it wouldn't be much of a worldview if there was no mixture, because the world contains both of those. I'm thinking of a poem that appears that hangs there in the show, and it's called The Farmers at Their Morning Coffee. In that poem, it's about farmers who like to get together and have their breakfast, and they like to tell some stretchers, and I don't know how the line goes, but it's relieve the truth of its shameful lack of color or something like that. And it's so I think you've got to have both of those things for sure. And to be honest about the world, you have to contain both of those things.
So Justin, when you're creating your work, do you just grab your bag with your camera and maybe a notepad and pen and just head out and look for things to photograph and look for things to be inspired by? Or do you just let them happen to you? Do you just go about your business and then just look at something and go, oh, I see something there, and then go capture it?
I carry a camera with me all the time, and I have a notepad with me all the time. And so I'm open to when something occurs. But I also have little trips that I'll take on the weekend kind of by myself. I'll get a big old cup of coffee and maybe play some old music. The idea is to really turn the GPS off and get lost. In poems and in photography, the element of surprise is a really big thing. And so you want to get lost in that. And so that's what I try to physically get lost when I'm out there taking pictures. And then I try metaphorically to get lost in a poem, you know, and not really know which turn I'm going to take next. So it's planned spontaneity.
Is it important to you that your photos and your poems must be appearing together? Would you feel at all that if your photos were on the wall and the poems weren't accompanying them, that there would be something missing, that the people who were viewing the photos are missing out somehow?
I think there'd be something missing for me more than for the viewer or the reader. I hope that I'm skillful enough as a poet that someone who reads my poetry would get the right kinds of images in their head. And on the other side of that coin, if somebody saw my pictures, you know, I hope that they are creating their own stories in their head or even imagining themselves in the scenes. So in that sense, they don't have to work together, but I think that from a personal expression standpoint, it gets to tell the full story of what I'm personally trying to do.
We're lucky here in the Twin Cities in that we have a number of galleries and spaces where people can show their work. Why did you feel, Justin, that the Normal Public Library was the place for your work to be seen as opposed to one of these other locations in town?
Well, I have several connections to the library there. Being a hometown boy, that's where I wrote my research papers when I was in high school. And so, you know, I have kind of emotional attachment to that library. Also, libraries in general. I mean, I am a K-12 school librarian, so I love to be involved in libraries and the things that they're doing for the public. And I think libraries that try to bring art to the public, that's just another way that libraries serve. And so I think that's really great.
Well, I noticed that your photographs are something a little extra. You have a metallic luster finish on some of your photos. Tell me about the choice you made to do that with your photos.
Well, that is something that came about through experimentation. People who see my photos will see that the look of my photos is very saturated. You know, I like a lot of color, and already the color kind of pops out of them. And I work with a lab in Kansas for my prints. One of the things that they offer is this metallic luster finish. I had ordered photographs from them, and I thought they looked great as they were, but just as a kind of an experiment, I ordered a couple of highly saturated photos to see what they would look like in that luster finish. And when I got them, they seem to just pop out of the frame when I put them in. The way that they're printed adds almost like a three-dimensional element, and it really makes that saturated color have an extra appeal to it. And so as soon as I saw that, that immediately became part of my style for when these pictures are printed. You know, they don't show up that way on a computer screen so much, but the beauty of the prints themselves is enhanced by the way that they print that.
When you go out and you take photos, folks who go out and take photos are often on their own taking pictures in the landscape. People who work as poets work alone. Poetry is not really a group sport, so to speak. So do you feel that these two disciplines sort of speak to each other because there is something of a solitary nature to the creative process?
Part of what appeals to me about both of those is I'm a pretty social person throughout the day. I mean, I have K through 12 students, and I'm constantly teaching classes and I'm talking to kids and other teachers. I'm social in that way, but by nature, I'm sort of an inward person. And so both of those arts appeal to that. I get a chance to do some thinking and I get a chance to do some introspection and, you know, maybe try to solve some problems in my head. And when I come out of a trip where I went and took some pictures or a writing session, I usually feel pretty refreshed after that.
That's photographer and poet Justin Hamm. Midwestern is on view at the Normal Public Library through July. He also has a new book coming out full of photos and poems called The Inheritance. I'm Laura Kennedy.
You can see photos of Justin Hamm's work or hear him read two of his poems at our website, wglt.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. When blues man Patrick Sweeney plays jazz up front tomorrow night, he'll be sporting a new release and a new recording he says gave him goosebumps during the recording process. GLT's John Norton has more.
The album is called I Want to Tell You. It was his debut album back in 1999. This is Blues All the Time.
I went to on that party.
His most recent new recording is last year's Ancient Noise. And as you can hear, it's a more plugged-in affair, more kin to the Black Keys than Robert Johnson. Sweeney says he recorded it at the fabled Sam Phillips Recording Studio in Memphis, which is not to be confused with Sun Records Recording Studio, where Phillips recorded Elvis Presley, Howlin' Wolf, Johnny Cash, Carl Perkins, and many other people we now call legends.
He never owned the building at Sun. So he, you know, he had always rented it, and he wanted to build his facility. So, and he used the cash from selling Elvis's contract as collateral for $1 million loan in 1958 to build. And it's two blocks away, like from the roof of Sam Phillips Recording, you can see Sun.
Okay, Patrick, it wasn't the original Sun Studios where a lot of these guys recorded these classic, 45s, but when you're recording in there, do you still feel those ghosts that Sam Phillips recorded?
Absolutely. Yeah. Some of those Sun 45s, but like all the Charlie Rich stuff was recorded there. Oh, you know, okay. There was Jerry Lee stuff recorded there, Fats Domino, you know, Wooly Bully was cut there. And I have done sessions at Sun. In fact, we taped a PBS special there with my band a few years prior to that, which is what led to the relationship between me and Matt Ross Spang, who produced and engineered that the Ancient Noise record.
Okay.
I mean, it's one of the greatest environments to perform music in that I've ever encountered. I mean, every bit of it, I mean, the vibe is, it's like Sun Records times 100.
Well, I was in Memphis a couple of years ago in January, and I went through Stax, the museum now.
Oh,
and
museum.
Once I got into the studio, especially where they did the studio, I was not prepared to be moved like that. I was just all by myself, and I was like, I got emotional just thinking about everything that happened there.
That's a very normal human reaction. It's a very emotional place when you think about all the artists of all that world-changing music. They poured everything they had onto those performances, onto tape in that very room, you know, and I'm a pretty down-to-earth guy, you know, but like, you know, that energy doesn't go away, you know. We're just talking about Newton's law here, you know. It can't be created, energy can't be created or destroyed. I was having so much fun just looking at all this, you know, nerding out, thinking, oh my God, they were here, and then you get up to the Otis part and they have that section of the plane and you see all them.
Yeah.
Them kids are saying, you know, go into the water, you know, 17 years old. So yeah, the Stax thing is, the museum is, it's heavy.
When you lose control, man, gotta get the help you can use. How to trust them.
Listening to a song from the Ancient Noise album by our guest Patrick Sweeney here on GLT Sound Ideas. His newest album is a re-release of his 1999 album, I Want to Tell You. Let's go back to the idea of Sun. Back in the 50s, late 40s through the early, maybe mid-1950s, when Sam Phillips was recording Elvis and Howlin' Wolf and Johnny Cash and Jerry Lee Lewis, James Cotton, and, you know, all of these people. These were guys he literally plucked off the street, or they literally just walked in, and he gave them a shot. Now, in today's world, Patrick, is there a parallel? Is there something similar to, you know, maybe a home studio, and you've got the internet to distribute? Is there any parallel to that?
I don't think so. Because we're just talking about a completely different planet. What Sam Phillips built didn't exist prior to him doing it. His principles of capturing something that's exciting and raw, his phrase is a perfect imperfection.
Well, I get what you're saying, because he loved the fact that somebody maybe messed up and it was just part of what they were. Where do you stand on that personally? Because you've been doing this now for over 20 years. Are you a perfectionist?
I'm a big fan, not necessarily by design.
Okay. So if you mess up in a studio, it's let's do it again or what?
Well, I mean, you always try, to play your best and to do your best. And sometimes that next take is the one. But, I mean, that's something, with the people I work with, I'm like, you've got to treat every take like it's the one. The way I like to record, I like the band in the room. I like to be singing live in there, with the big enough. And that's the nice thing about Phillips is, like, we could do it right in there off the floor and try to get as much as you can happening right, in real time.
The song comes from the album Ancient Now. It's the newest recording from our guest, Patrick Sweeney. This is GLT's Sound Ideas. Now, Patrick, this isn't your most recent release because, as we said earlier, you just put out your debut album from 1999, which is an unplugged affair. But hearing Ancient Now, boy, it makes sense that you are a fan, at least I hear, a fan of the great Alligator Records recording artist Hound Dog Taylor.
Oh, my God. The reason I put a band together was because of Hound Dog Taylor. And it was back in the very early 2000s. I was also playing local gigs around Ohio and subbing guitar, playing guitar for a blues band or two, and then trying to do my own trio. And I just loved the sound of those Hound Dog Taylor records. But, a lot of the bass players I knew, everyone's trying to play five strings. Those started to get hit. And all this kind of like modern kind of sounds, I'm just like, man, this does not sound as good. My trio was playing our regular Monday night residency. A friend of mine, a guy named Mike Lenz from Ohio, was like, hey, I got this kid I'm giving lessons to. He's real into Hound Dog Taylor, too. You guys should hang out. You should have him sit in or something. I'm like, well, man, yeah, have him come out to the gig and introduce himself. And so I think it's like around 2000 or so, maybe a little after, that Dan Arbach came and sat in. And then he knew all the Brewer Phillips parts, and I knew all the Hound Dog Taylor parts. And Brewer Phillips was the second guitar player in Hound Dog Taylor's House Rockers. And they did two guitars and drums. And Brewer would just turn the bass up all the way on his amplifier and play in the lower register. And Hound Dog would play the upper register. And then they would switch.
Well, Patrick, I should interject here that Dan Arbach is the force, at least half of the force, behind the Black Keys. And now he is an in-demand producer. He's probably produced hundreds of albums. All right, go ahead.
So eventually our bass player quit, and then Dan joined the band for a little while. And we were doing that two guitars and drums thing. And so yeah, I'm a huge fan of the energy of, I was always an Elmore James fan, and Hound Dog Taylor is definitely a, in line with that sort of what slide guitar sound, electric slide sound that Elmore sort of pioneered.
Bluesman Patrick Sweeney plays jazz up front tomorrow night. He spoke with GLT's John Norton. Bloomington's Matthew Curry is also on the bill. Discover other local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois on the GLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. WGLT.org is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Eric Stock, Laura Kennedy, John Norton, and Ryan Denham. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.